Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, and heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the program, polls show Evan McMullen with a lead in Utah, some polls anyway. Plus, the State Water Development Commission draws criticism from opponents of the Lake Powell and Bear River pipelines. The Salt Lake City Council pulls money from the city's redevelopment agency to pay for new shelters and affordable housing initiatives, and quite a bit more. And joining me in the studio this morning, Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Matt Canham. Matt, good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. Robert Gerke, government reporter as well. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you.
Environment reporter Emma Penrod also joins us. Good morning, Emma.
Good morning.
And government and online reporter Tony Semerad is with us. Tony, good morning.
Hello.
Also, at Tribune editorial writer George Pyle is in studio as well. A full house. George, welcome.
Good morning.
Listeners, which stories caught your attention this past week? Chime in with your questions and comments by calling us at 801-355-TALK or posting your comments at sltrib.com. We've had so much in the way of politics over the past few weeks that maybe to start with today, we'll go somewhere else. Though, of course, I'm sure there's a political angle to this story as well, if we look hard enough. Emma Penrod, environment reporter, a state commission, the Water Development Commission, held a meeting on Tuesday, and they came up with essentially a draft version of how to allocate money out of the account that has been set up to fund the Lake Powell and Bear River pipelines. But the draft rules that they set up weren't exactly clear. Tell us about what happened at this meeting.
Yeah, so the rules were actually drafted by some other water boards in the state. But the State Water Development Commission is part of the several entities that will be determining how this money is allocated. And so they were reviewing a report from the Division of Water Resources about the rules, about their progress toward this. In the process, it came up that in the rules designed to dictate how money from this account, which was, if you remember, created by SB 80 this past legislative session, they were trying to determine how this money should be spent and what projects should get the money from the account.
Right.
And one of the rules in that, it was several pages of conditions, read, beneficiaries of projects to develop the Colorado and Bear Rivers as described in the Lake Powell Pipeline Development Act and Bear River Development Act will be required to provide at least 10% of the project cost.
Okay. And that was something that drew some criticism because just being required to pay 10% of the project cost seemed like a little too little for the amount of money that these projects will cost, to some critics of this, obviously.
Yes. Well, the critics felt that when you say, you know, at least 10%, that what could happen is you end up with some organizations that might pay 10.1% and call it good. The problem with that is that the Lake Powell Pipeline Development Act actually says that the recipients of the water must pay for the cost of developing that water through buying the water from the state. The way that's set up, the state will build the Lake Powell Pipeline according to this act. It will own and operate the Lake Powell Pipeline for the first bit, and it will create a price that it will charge Washington County water buyers for the use of that water, and that price of the water will cover what it cost the state to build the Lake Powell Pipeline. Once their costs have been covered, they have the option to turn the operation of the Lake Powell Pipeline over to the Washington County Water Conservancy District.
Instead of the state holding it. Mm-hmm. So as I recall, the account was set up, this account that we're talking about was set up for these projects, but the state legislature said it would revisit and approve these projects, meaning the Lake Powell pipeline and mm-hmm. the Bear River pipeline, at a later date, meaning money was set aside, but the projects themselves weren't exactly, I guess, signed off on. Is that accurate to say?
Yeah, that's accurate to say. The Lake Powell Pipeline Development Act does basically say the state will build this pipeline.
Okay.
That being the case, it needs to go through a lot of permitting. There's a lot of, you know, they haven't figured out exactly what route it will take. The engineering isn't finished. So there's a lot of things still that remain to be done. And also the Development Act is contingent upon they have to have contracts to sell at least 70% of the water that would come from the pipeline. So if somebody, you know, say the Washington County Water Conservancy District dropped out and said, we don't want the water anymore, no pipeline.
Hmm. Okay, so the rules in this meeting, they have that 10% language, so a little bit of confusing mm-hmm. language, especially conflicting with the Lake Powell Water Pipeline Act or whatever it's called. I'm sorry, I've got that wrong.
That's fine.
If that 10% rule stood, who would be on the hook for paying for these projects? Just taxpayers? Is that? I mean, I guess that this has to be resolved. It's too confusing and needs to be sort of sorted out.
Yeah. The way that would stand is, theoretically, if they paid 10%, I suppose, the money would, you know, be coming out of the water infrastructure restricted account, is what they're calling it. That money is tax money. It's the sales taxes that are being diverted into that account. And presumably it would just be spent.
Okay.
There was, as they pointed out in the meeting, the Division of Water Resources, Eric Millis, the director there, said, hey, you know, we're sorry. We meant to say up front that they had to pay 10% up front.
Okay, so missing language.
Uh-huh. And he did admit, you know, as they were reviewing it, you know, yes, that is unclear. It doesn't really specify that the 10% was to be up front, but he said that was our intent. And he has promised that they will revise that and make sure that it's clear that it's 10% up front and that the Development Act still stands and that they still have to reimburse the state for the costs.
How soon would that kind of, I guess we should talk about a time frame of this. I mean, the critics like Zach Frankel, who's the head of the Utah Rivers Council, mm-hmm. are concerned about both the environmental impacts of the Lake Powell Pipeline, also the Bear River Pipeline. And they're also not convinced that these projects are even necessary. Is that right?
That is their concern, and then their primary arguments against it is that this is not a necessary project, that the water could come from other cheaper sources, and there is really a lot of concern about the economic impact of this project. This project is expected to cost multiple billions of dollars, and this is not, you know, the largest community in the state that is being, in theory, asked to pay for this. And there's a lot of concern that means either that all state taxpayers will essentially end up funding this, or else that it could cause water rates to increase to such a degree in Washington County that it would no longer be
affordable.
Yeah.
No. Mm-hmm. A quick reminder to our listeners that you can join this conversation. We'd be happy to field your questions and comments. We are at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. How about a time frame on these projects? Again, as I mentioned, there's the allocation of money, but not necessarily the sign-off on the mm-hmm. projects themselves. What are we looking at there?
There's a lot of things that are still unknown about the projects. We're talking about the allocation of money, but we don't have a final cost estimate yet. They've given some ballpark ranges, you know, a couple billion, but they've said that all depends on which route we decide to take, which has not been finalized. They've proposed a couple different routes they could take the pipeline across, but they haven't picked one. They still have some design elements up in the air a little bit. They have filed their application with FERC, that's a Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, mm-hmm. which will be reviewing this. They will be the first agency to review this and determine whether it's going to be approved to operate. And it has to obtain a lot of permits before it can be built. And that first review can probably take a couple years.
And in terms of room for public input on this and when that can happen now? I mean, some of it, I guess, has already happened.
Well, there was a public comment period on the license application last winter, about this time a year ago. That has since been filed, so it's now undergoing review. There are, you know, there's meetings like yesterday, or like Tuesday's meeting.
Where people showed up.
There's a public comment period. So I don't know if there's really like a current open period where people can submit their comment on this, but there are opportunities that do come up, that do arise.
And otherwise, the time frame could be well into the future, depending upon how mm-hmm. different agencies look at this and mm-hmm. Whether or not they sign off on it. Fascinating reporting. You know, speaking of the allocation of government funds, I'm going to turn to another story here. Robert Gerke, this week you reported on an audit and on the departure of the head of a state-funded entity, the Economic Development Corporation of Utah, a scathing audit. First off, what does the Economic Development Corporation of Utah do?
Yeah, I suspect not a lot of people are familiar with the entity. It's a nonprofit that was set up to do sort of the out-of-state business recruitment for Utah. And so they go out and sort of woo these businesses. They were heavily involved, for example, in the Facebook attempts to bring Facebook to Utah, and that was a deal that failed. But they've had a number that have been successful, and so they're sort of a recruitment arm. They work closely with the governor's Office of Economic Development, and they have like about a $3 million budget, and 2/3 of that comes from taxpayers, either state or local taxpayers. And so there had been some questions that had arisen about the way they were using this money. Right. In particular, I think one of the things that alarmed legislators was that for 5 years they failed to file their tax returns, the required tax returns, and lost their tax-exempt status, and that went unnoticed for 2 years. And so this legislative audit that came out this week, you know, affirmed that and said that, you know, that was a pretty egregious oversight. But it also raised questions about the way that a former executive, his name's Todd Brightwell, was using his company card. There were a number about $90,000 worth of charges that didn't have appropriate justification. There were a number of charges that were things that he definitely should not have been using it for things like pottery and things like paying a speeding ticket.
And maybe some technology. I mean, there was Apple Store purchases.
There were numerous Apple Store purchases, and some of the equipment that he had purchased from the Apple Store was no longer in possession of EDC Utah. So they can't account for it.
So, despite those findings, Brightwell, this is the chief operating officer of EDC Utah. He got a severance package, right?
He got a pretty juicy severance package. He got several months' pay. He got health insurance coverage. He got a vehicle. Apparently, got these iPhones, iPad things, and so so he got a juicy severance package. The president and CEO of EDC Utah, a week before the audit was released, announced his retirement at the end of the month. The agency says, well, it's not related to the audit. He just feels like this is a good time to go because he's completed all the reforms that the audit recommended. So you can read into that what you will. But he did take responsibility for some of these oversights, especially in particular the failure to file the tax returns and loss of tax-exempt status, things that he said he should have been on top of.
And that was for 5 years that they hadn't.
For 5 years, from 2010 to 2014 is five tax returns that they didn't file. Yeah.
So you said that you know, he had implemented changes in terms of recommendations from the audit. Have things changed considerably? I mean, aside from the departure of two heads of the group?
It appears that they have. I mean, they've created this finance board. It's a small finance board with some top-notch business finance people. People like Scott Anderson from Zions Bank is on it. The regional vice president for Wells Fargo is on it. So they've created this finance board. They've hired a new chief financial officer. They brought in an auditing firm to kind of make sure they had to bring in an auditing firm to reconstruct and file those previous tax returns. But they have an auditor on staff, you know, who's under contract. So it appears that they've actually put some changes in place that should, in theory, help keep this stuff from happening again.
George Pyle from the editorial desk. Any comments on I guess what this audit found and you know, I don't know, the state of things at the Economic Development Corporation of Utah?
We say the word scathing audit so often in the paper. I'm trying to think maybe we should come up with some different words just for variety. But
yes,
sometimes that's what you need to say. I mean, this was another one of them. You wonder about the claim of Utah being the best managed state, if this is an example of that. If best managed means rich friends get to give each other nice severance packages and nobody notices, if that's what you mean by best managed, we're at the top. Well, I don't know. New Jersey's probably worse, but
sorry, New Jersey.
This is another one of those things where, you know, we have these agencies and nobody's really sure what they do, and they have boards that are supposed to be looking over them, and they don't seem to be doing it. We're mad at UTA, we're mad at DABC, or all these things that are supposed to be, you know, government services to people, and at least we have these audits. At least we have the state audit, and they come along and they seem to. Tell it like it is and get people to reform at least for a while and get people to retire when maybe they shouldn't be hanging around there anymore. But sometimes you wonder, like, this is – why do we need this organization and GOED? Like, couldn't we just have GOED and then we could focus on who's doing what and where they're spending the money? It seems like every once in a while – I mean, this is a legislative thing. People come from all over the state and they want to do something and they want to tell their constituents they created something, so they create another agency that maybe sometimes duplicates this agency down the hall, but by golly, they created something.
Well, George Pyle's comments from the editorial desk here. We have come to the point where we have to take our first break in the show. We will transition into the realm of politics coming up next, as some recent polling shows Evan McMullen with a lead over those other presidential candidates. Listeners, call us to join the discussion. 801-355-TALK is the number. Back after the break, you're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the Salt Lake Tribune Reporter News Roundup, heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham, Robert Gerke, Emma Penrod, and Tony Semerad. You can join the conversation commenting at the Behind the Headlines page, currently live at sltrib.com, or by calling us up at 801-355-TALK. 17 days till election now. I've received my ballot, as I'm sure many other Utahns who vote by mail have. But with not much more than 2 weeks to go, the major party candidates, at least by one poll in the presidential race, don't have the advantage in Utah. Matt Canham, one poll puts Evan McMullen, an outsider candidate, in the lead. Is that right?
That's right. And I guess the biggest question is, who is Evan McMullen and how did this happen? Utah is completely unique in this scenario. There are multiple media organizations that have said Utah is a swing state, but we're the only swing state that is considering a third-party candidate. And that's because in Utah, Hillary Clinton is a non-starter and Donald Trump has become toxic. And so if you're a conservative voter, where do you turn? Before the Access Hollywood tape came out showing Donald Trump talking about groping women because he has star power and he can get away with it, there was a lot of split anti-Trump votes between Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate, right, and Evan McMullen, who's an independent conservative. He's Mormon but has no real major organization. He's not a high-profile figure. He's never held public office or ran for anything. But just by the nature of his candidacy, they were about even, you know, 13, 14 points each. That video comes out and people really start looking hard for an alternative. And it looks like there's been a stampede towards McMullen.
Those who left Trump didn't go to Gary Johnson. They went to Evan McMullen.
Well, not only that, but people who were voting for Gary Johnson had said, okay, no, seriously, we need to find someone else and we need to get someone who can win. And I think Evan McMullen has a better shot.
Gary Johnson had that big, Gary Johnson had that big mistake too with the Aleppo moment and then his camp not able to name a foreign leader. And I think everybody kind of jumped ship. And especially when they saw Evan McMullen is like, well, maybe this guy's
it's
a more viable alternative.
Let's hear about his background a little bit. I mean, we've talked about this some on the show, but Evan McMullen's own personal background.
Yeah. He spent 11 years in the CIA. Overseas as an agent. He then came back, went to the Wharton Business School, spent 3 years working for Goldman Sachs in San Francisco before moving to congressional staff. He was a congressional staffer in the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Don't know what the right terminology is there. And then went to the House Republican Conference as a policy director. He was in that job when he decided to run for president in August. He quit his job to run as an independent because he was appalled that Republicans weren't rejecting Donald Trump. He considers Donald Trump not only not a Republican, but a racist. And for him, he's said in multiple interviews that if you can't be for equality, you can't be a conservative. You can't be, you know, and if this guy is a racist, why aren't we calling him out on it? Why are we supporting this? So he wanted to be an alternative.
You know, we talked about the seeming implosion of the Trump campaign last week after those comments and some accusations from women, growing accusations, as a matter of fact. But it's worth revisiting how remarkable this year is. Utah is almost considered an automatic lock for Republican
candidates. It is considered an automatic lock. I mean, people don't even poll here most of the time because it's irrelevant.
That's amazing. I mean, and then so meanwhile, the Clinton campaign is seeing improved chances here as well. They see maybe a window of opportunity despite the fact that Evan McMullen is surging. So they are investing some resources in in Utah as well.
They're shifting some staff here. They're at least say they're going to spend more money on TV ads and even bring in more surrogates. We shouldn't hold our breath to see, you know, about seeing Hillary Clinton enter the state. But other people who are supporting her are probably going to visit. For them, they realize that for Hillary Clinton to take Utah means that Trump and McMullen continue to have to battle it out, split it enough that she can kind of sneak in. But at the same time, what their goal is to make sure that if you are in any way inclined to vote for Hillary Clinton, that you actually vote.
Right.
A recognition that your vote in this state matters, probably or as much as in any state. We've had six polls since that Access Hollywood video came out. Of those six, three show statistical ties between the three candidates. Mm. One shows McMullen up 4 points, and then two showed Trump in the lead, but those were earlier in the process.
Okay.
So it matters.
And yep. There's some strategy, I think, that goes on here, too, is because if Clinton comes in and spends money, it forces Trump to come in and spend money. And Trump doesn't have very much money left at this point. And so and if they can – even if Utah doesn't go to Clinton, if it goes to McMullen, that's actually a win for Clinton because it keeps those six electoral votes out of Trump's column. So it makes it that much harder for Trump to win. Now, the chances of McMullen actually pulling this off, it's sort of, if I can use a football comparison, it's like throwing a Hail Mary pass uphill riding a unicycle while you're blindfolded.
That's a football. I had no idea that was
yeah,
a football.
That's football. Yeah. That's, it happens.
It's a special play.
Yeah. Trick play. But so it's almost impossible for him to actually but you know, he can be a spoiler, particularly here in Utah.
That he acknowledges that he has little to no chance to actually be president. So the way this would work is it would have to be a close enough race that both Clinton and Trump split the Electoral College vote, and neither of them get the 270 votes necessary to become president. And since he wins at least one state, he would then be considered when the House of Representatives decides who our president is. This process has happened twice in the early 1800s and never since. Mm. Now, he knows, he can read polls like the rest of us, Donald Trump's losing right now and losing pretty significantly. So he's not... Evan McMullen's not under the impression that this is a likely scenario.
I know that he's made comments saying, look, your vote for me isn't a vote for Hillary Clinton because essentially it's almost inevitable that she's going to win the country as it is. So you're making a vote about the conservative movement. And that's, I mean, interesting point to make.
Right. If Donald Trump's going to lose anyway, why don't you stand on principle and make a vote you can feel good about is how he puts it. And there's some legitimacy to that.
Well, there's an argument, and it's an argument that's being heard here. There's been a few state lawmakers who have endorsed him. But a lot of Utah's all of Utah's members of Congress, the governor, lieutenant governor, none of them have come to support him. Mitt Romney hasn't backed him. So there's still a hesitancy about getting behind this guy. I think part of it is interesting in the sense that he wants to be involved in creating a new conservative movement, which might be outside of the Republican Party. That also is, I think, fascinating. You have a relatively unknown congressional staffer who not only decides – I'm a person who can run for president and stop Donald Trump, but I'm also a person who can lead a conservative movement afterward. That is really putting yourself out there.
Is it also maybe conceivably a platform for a future, a future run at something else? I guess.
I mean, one run tends to lead to another. It happens all the time. So that's possible. He's not saying he's considering that. But why wouldn't you, if you build a platform and you have a certain base of support, at least consider a run in the future? Now, Evan McMullen lives in Washington, D.C. So if he was going to run in Utah, he needs to kind of relocate. And right now, he doesn't have a job. So he might want to start there after this campaign.
Well, it's an interesting story. We do have a caller on the line who has a question related to this story. We've got Rob in St. George with a question about Gary Johnson, I guess. Rob, are you there? Let's see. Rob, are you there? I'm missing Rob. Hold on 1 second. Rob, are you there? Rob, one more time. Are you there?
I'm here.
There you are. Great.
I can hear you.
Fantastic. So you have a question about Gary Johnson and politics in Utah. Go ahead and ask your question.
Right. Thank you. And I did want to correct your statement earlier that you said Gary Johnson in that Hardball interview could not name a foreign leader. I'm looking at the transcript right now, and the question was, who is your favorite foreign leader? And then he asked him, name one foreign leader that you respect. And he couldn't come up with that answer, and he still maintains that there's not one that is his favorite or that he respects. So okay. I think it's you're just repeating kind of something that is out there that's not correct. However, I am curious, as a Gary Johnson supporter, but also an observer of Utah politics, why your panel, I'll put this out of the panel, why so many Utahns, when they had non-Trump or never Trump, never Hillary options, skipped over Gary Johnson and went to Evan McMullen. And the party thing I think is interesting because Mr. McMullen is not even affiliated with a political party, so there is kind of no end game after this election. Would the Republicans even let him and his supporters back? Because there is that, you know, disloyalty factor that's there. So
Rob, thank you.
Is it the social conservative part? I'll leave it there.
Thank you for your question, and we will address it right now. How about that? I mean, the idea that this is does Evan McMullen sort of tend to be more on the Republican side of things, actually?
I mean, he worked for the Republicans in August. So he is a more traditional Republican candidate. He talks a lot about first principles and the Constitution. He is much more in the normal realm of Republican politics. He also is Mormon and born in Provo and went to BYU, which probably gives him some advantage here. Okay. Gary Johnson had, you know, the mid-teens support for much of this. I do think he had some stumbles on foreign policy that hurt. I also think his support here was soft. He was a place to go if you did not want to vote for Trump. And then when it came down to it and there was another alternative and these voters looked at both of them, they made a choice. When I talk to some voters, often in Utah, Gary Johnson's position on marijuana and the legalization of marijuana is not popular among Mormon voters in Utah.
This is not medical marijuana, but just marijuana in general. Is
right.
That,
okay. And you know, there's a hesitancy. The LDS Church has a hesitancy on, you know, they put out a statement last week about urging Mormons in states where there are ballot initiatives on legalizing marijuana to vote against it. So that alone is, if you don't know a lot about Gary Johnson, that's one thing you know. And if you're comparing, it's easy to go to a person who feels more like a traditional Republican than a libertarian.
Yeah, he's also pro-choice, pro-gay marriage, and you know, anti-foreign involvement in you know, military conflicts. And I think that's contrary to the traditional Republican line. So like Matt said, when these Republicans were looking to go somewhere, anywhere else, they initially flocked to Gary Johnson and then moved away when they had another alternative.
Well, Rob, in St. George, we hope that answers your question. We could spend, I think, a fair deal of time here on the presidential election, and we will kind of stay with this theme for just a moment longer. I've actually got a follow-up question from a story that we covered last week. Robert Gerke, we talked about Utah Republican Party Chair James Evans sticking with the Trump campaign or with the nominee, even when other Utah Republicans were abandoning ship. Evans said something a bit controversial on national television in an interview with CNN, and he reiterated this idea that Bill Clinton had a child out of wedlock. Mm-hmm. An interesting assertion. And then after those statements, Evans, in addition to facing down some criticism, also received some racist and threatening phone calls. Tell us about that. That happened this week.
Yeah, so James Evans was after this interview on CNN, they started getting some sort of threatening, hostile calls. One of them in particular said that Evans, who is black, is lucky he's not being lynched. Hmm. He took that as a direct threat and notified law enforcement. He also took a sort of a significant step in shutting down the party headquarters for the duration of the election to make sure that, you know, the staff is not put in any danger. Now, it looks like this call came from Texas, a guy who's a bit of a wild card in terms of, like, you know, just the stuff that he's said in social media and so forth. I don't know if there's actual direct risk or any danger for the staff or for Evans, but, you know, it drew some national attention, and it drew some pretty vile comments.
Well,
it
looks like it comes from this gentleman. It sounds almost like a hate crime. How is it being investigated? Is somebody actually going, you know, if it is this guy in Texas, is there some sort of charges pending? I don't know.
Well, I think it's probably too early for that. James did say he was notifying the law enforcement. It's kind of interesting because at this point, I guess you'd have to notify the FBI. since it happened across state lines. But so I think there could be an investigation, but at this point it's still very early on in the process.
Okay. At one point, James Evans said that this was sort of the doing of Democrats.
Well, he pinned it on Clinton supporters, and to be frank, I mean, when we look at the guy who left this message was probably not very bright, because he did leave a message that with his caller ID number. The caller ID, his number came up. We called the number. He said, "I don't know anything about it." But you track it back to that number, and this guy has a long list of Facebook posts, anti-Trump Facebook posts. He has stuff on his Twitter account where he's like, "I hope Donald Trump's assassinated by a Muslim," and things like that. "I'll be dancing when he is."
Wow.
And so, you know, there's some stuff there that would indicate that maybe this actually is the guy who did that. Hmm. And so, you know, if it is, then you know, it doesn't take a lot to figure out.
Okay. Well, just jumping back to the sort of original story here that kicked all of this off, is the state Republican Party still backing the GOP nominee? I mean, I guess it's at this point, with ballots out in mailboxes and voting already happening, maybe it's a moot point. But
they are. James is sort of having to walk a fine line, though, because he doesn't want to upset the establishment political elected officials here. And here's an interesting sort of piece of this is that, you know, the party always has its election night party, its celebration. And a lot of the elected officials, Mike Lee, Mia Love, Jason Chaffetz, Gary Herbert, are not going to that. Now, part of the reason that they're not going to that is because James initially had suggested that they pay up to $10,000 to rent space at the party. But another reason that they're not going, it's been suggested, is that they don't want to be in a centrally located place on a night where, you know, they're going to be asked questions about Trump and from the media that shows up. So they're distancing themselves from it. And also, was it Tommy that did the story about Mike Lee's reaction to Donald Trump in the rigged election? You know, he was asked about that, and he says it's shocking, and it's I think he said horrifying or disappointing. That Trump would suggest that the election could be rigged and the outcome could be tilted against him.
Well, and he said it's frightening beyond my ability to describe.
There you
in
go.
An interview with the Daily Universe, the paper at Brigham Young University.
This is Jason Chaffetz.
No, that was Mike Lee.
Excuse me. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think the interesting part about the presidential race with the delegation is you have Orrin Hatch and Rob Bishop saying that they will vote for Donald Trump. You have Mia Love and Mike Lee saying they're not going to vote for Donald Trump, but not saying who they're going to support. And you have Jason Chaffetz and Chris Stewart who don't want to answer the question.
Mm-hmm.
They say they're undecided, which means they're leaving open the possibility of voting for Trump. This question is not going to go away. So whether it's election night or some other time, we are going to continue to ask.
To ask whether or not they supported or voted for Donald Trump. George, just talking politics here for a second, the assertions by Donald Trump that, the election is rigged. Mike Lee called this dangerous. A lot of people have called this statement sort of dangerous for American democracy.
Yeah, it just sounds like Donald Trump is just setting up his post-election insurgency. People are saying that really all he really wants to do is start his own TV network and outfox Fox on the, you know, rounding up all the neo-Nazis and the grumpy old white men to sell commercials for sleep aids and hearing aids and those really cool canes that they have now, because that's who advertises there. But, you know, if you're really going to go against all this American tradition and say, nope, I don't believe the election outcome, it's all rigged, it's all fixed. I mean, I've covered elections in little towns and big towns, and I don't see how you could fix an election. There are too many people looking over too many shoulders, all the election officials all across the country, except back in Kansas where I'm from, which is we don't talk about, but are saying there's no way that you could fix the election. But you also have to say, if there was a grand conspiracy to fix the election, that's exactly what they would be saying.
Right. Well, vote early and vote often.
Yes. Vote.
You know, it's time for another quick break here. But when we come back, some news closer to the Salt Lake City area here, some novel moves by the Salt Lake City Council to fund some efforts aimed at homelessness and affordable housing. First, though, a couple of quick messages. You are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm KCPW producer Roger McDonough, joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Robert Gerke, George Pyle, Matt Canham, Emma Penrod, and Tony Semerad. And listeners, you can join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. Tony Semerad, on Tuesday of this week, the Salt Lake City Council, raided the budget of the city's redevelopment agency to pay for some measures having to do with homelessness and affordable housing. Tell us what happened and whose initiative this was.
Well, yeah, by any definition, a big week for those issues in Salt Lake. The Salt Lake City Council has been hearing a variety of testimony as the issue of homelessness and specifically the conditions around the shelters downtown have been worsening. You know, these issues have been on their agenda for 2 or 3 years. They're knuckling down at this point on citing some additional homeless services centers. There's talk of at least 4 150-bed shelters that'll be going in around around the area to kind of diffuse some of the concentration of the homeless
locations yet to be decided.
Yet to be determined. And so in their process for selecting those sites, they had to set aside some money that was characterized as kind of an emergency. They convened, as the Salt Lake City Council does, as the governing board of the redevelopment agency, which is sort of this subunit of city government focused on urban renewal. And in kind of looking through their budget to come up with anywhere from about $8 million to $12 million to buy these homeless sites, they kind of kept going. They put those funds aside from a couple of line items in the RDA's pending budget.
Can I actually just interrupt you there for 1 second and ask, because I had thought that there was state funding for the new for the new shelters that came from last year's legislative session.
Yeah, there is, and so it's sort of a question of timing. The city has to go into the real estate market and actually put bids out on some of this land. They're fully hoping that this, that whatever money they commit, whether they own city-owned property or whether they have to buy stuff, will get reimbursed by the state, although they're acknowledging that's not guaranteed. But just to kind of get the process moving now, you know, the site selections are supposed to be coming down about mid-November, at least the locations, the options will start to emerge. And so they needed the money quickly. That's kind of why they went to the RDA budget. The city's broader budget is kind of done. And in a very interesting hearing on Tuesday, the city council kind of made good on talk in the last couple of weeks to go big on the issue of affordable housing, which they now see as kind of inextricably linked to the conditions of the homeless. And so after amassing this $11.8 million fund for these homeless services sites, they continued and basically amassed another, approximately $20 million that they could put for affordable housing. It was sort of, in a way, kind of budgeting on the fly. I mean, their motives were kind of well thought out, but they sort of seized the opportunity of having these discretionary items from the RDA in front of them to pull from a variety of development projects around the city and make this kind of affordable housing war chest.
And this is something that they received some criticism for, people calling it a kind of sneak attack or whatever. I mean, I know that Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski, for example, the day after the meeting had some comments about this.
Yeah. I mean, this is going on amid a kind of a reorganization of the distribution of powers over the RDA. And the mayor is interested in asserting a little bit kind of more control. And she's, in accordance with state law, appointed herself the executive director. So she and RDA staff were somewhat concerned about this, kind of reappropriation of the money. And, the city council's quite adamant that it's been looking at this. They've been talking about a $4 to $5 million fund specifically to kind of guide affordable housing projects over to the east side, where they think residents are going to have a little bit more economic opportunity. And, this has been rising on their agenda for some time. They've been interested in creating this fund at the RDA. And while there was a sort of a give and take quality to the meeting on Tuesday, they're standing firm that this, you know, makes good on affordable housing being a high priority for the city.
This is council members in particular. I mean, Derek Kitchen and Councilmember Aaron Mendenhall sort of led this charge, and they say that affordable housing should essentially be the top focus of the city at this time.
Right, and there's an ironic quality to all of that, because I think the mayor would say it's a top priority, so would the RDA staff, but they seem to be kind of going on different scales or in different directions in terms of how to address this. Now, an important thing to remember here is this is working with spending proposals. This was money that is sort of earmarked for these variety of development projects that's now been pulled out of this fund. And there's differing opinion, I should say, in City Hall as to just how much this is going to affect what the RDA does going forward.
Okay.
With RDA staff saying, you know, hey, this is a significant shift in our mission, and the City Council being more sort of the opinion that, you know, we have a lot of discretionary spending that we do, and this fits the RDA's mission.
Sort of a process question here, but is this just a done deal now? I mean, the money that was moved, it won't be moved back or anything like that. I mean,
my hunch is there might be a little bit more debate to go. The staffers for Jackie Biskupski, right after the vote was taken on Tuesday, or right before the vote was taken on Tuesday, sort of asked for a little bit more time, and the council was adamant about not giving that additional time. They went ahead with the motion in spite of a plea to kind of for some additional study. But there could, again, these are spending proposals. Mm-hmm. They're scheduled to take some public input on this issue as early as next week. And they're also going to be, you know, beginning conversations about how they spend this money, which is another very interesting part of this debate.
Right. And there's, two aspects of it, one being the purchase of land for the shelters, the other being how that affordable housing component gets split up.
Yeah, gets split up. But in answer to your question, I think there is a little bit more to go on this.
Okay. We're really low on time here, and I do want to get to a couple of other stories, or at least one more story before we go on. And so maybe we'll leave it there. But Tony Samarad, thanks for the reporting. Listeners, you can find it at sltrib.com. I actually want to go back to the world of environmental coverage, a story about ozone levels in Utah. And Emma Penrod, various Utah counties don't meet new federal ozone guidelines. And so the state wants the EPA to make them non-attainment areas. What does that mean?
Yeah, so what that means, under the Clean Air Act, there is a process for remediating, I guess, air quality, you could say. The Clean Air Act says, it's illegal to have air that doesn't meet these standards. Those standards are revised every couple of years. We got a new ozone standard, and now we're at the process, because that new ozone standard was released, that the state of Utah has its regulators look at the air throughout Utah, look at the data that we have, and determine where in the state of Utah does not meet, ozone the new ozone standard. Then when they make those determinations, they forward their report to the governor, who then makes his recommendation to the EPA as to the areas that he believes, that the state believes, do not meet the new criteria, the new standard for ozone. And then the EPA will review that and, give it its approval or rejection, and then it's a non-attainment area or it's not.
And so a non-attainment area, though, I guess in that instance, you get a little bit more leeway as a state to develop a plan to address the ozone, whereas if you don't, what happens there? I mean,
I guess arguably you don't have as much leeway.
Okay.
I guess, theoretically, you could develop a plan on your own if you so chose. But once you are deemed to be in a non-attainment situation, then the federal regulation says you must create a plan for addressing this problem. There is no longer an option. You have to make a plan. That plan has to be approved by the EPA, and it has to meet certain deadlines. Take, for example, our situation with the small particulate pollution, the PM2.5. We have some non-attainment areas for that last December did not meet their deadline for attainment under previous plans. Because of that, they are now subject to reclassification as a serious non-attainment, which means that the EPA is going to be even more strict about the measures Utah must plan to take to address PM2.5.
And so is the... I guess, is the governor sort of inviting the EPA into this process a way of maybe thwarting that aspect from happening, or is it just sort of, look, we've got to deal with this somehow, and let's get it done?
Well, it's a requirement. He has to do this.
Okay. So why are the ozone levels that we have as bad as they are here in northern Utah, in parts of northern Utah?
Well, it's not just northern Utah. There's actually a problem in the Uinta Basin as well, which is that particular situation is unique. That is now a proposed non-attainment area. And they actually have problems with ozone in the winter. Now, ozone is kind of a unique pollutant in the sense that it isn't, you know, emitted by anything. Ozone is not coming directly out of smokestacks or directly out of cars. Ozone is created in the air through a series of chemical reactions that's triggered by sunlight and requires the presence of precursor chemicals, which are the pollutants which are emitted from your cars or from your homes or from your factories. When those are present, when sunlight's present, they combine, they make ozone.
Right.
Now, you know, that makes ozone usually a summertime problem because you need an abundance of sunlight to trigger this reaction. On the Wasatch Front, it is a summertime problem, and most of the precursor pollutants seem to be coming primarily from cars. That's not unusual. They've seen that, you know, L.A., for example.
Mm-hmm.
In the Uinta Basin, though, it's in the winter that they're seeing these spikes of ozone.
And the reason is?
The assumption is that there is the oil and gas industry there that is releasing the precursor pollutants, and then that when there's an inversion, which makes these pollutants especially concentrated, then the sunlight reflects off of snow on the ground, and that provides enough sunlight to trigger the reaction. But this is a new thing. It was assumed for many, many years that ozone didn't happen in the winter, and so no one was really even monitoring for it in the winter.
Wow.
It was only in, you know, really an accident almost that the problem was even discovered.
Emma, I'm going to give you just like 30 seconds to tell us what the health issues are that that can arise from exposure to levels of ozone.
Yeah, ozone, it's bad for your lungs. It's kind of it's like it burns your lungs, so to speak. Like having chemical burns, it's generally not a good thing, can cause permanent lung damage.
Okay. And I bet listeners can get a greater description in your reporting when they check it out at sltrip.com.
Yes.
Sorry to have to cut you off, but
okay.
The hour is coming to a close, and it is time right now to turn to our underplayed stories of the week. And is anybody ready right now with an underplayed story? Tony Semerad.
I'm going to recommend listeners and readers check out Mike Gorell's coverage of the $90 million county park bond. It's a very interesting list of projects, and it strikes me as interesting in that it's one of these where a government entity is kind of diverting a tax stream over, an existing tax stream over. But anyway, check out that story
at sltrip.com. George Pyle, have you got one ready?
Well, I'd just like to commend people's attention to the commentary around the internet about Utah, about Evan McMullen, people describing Utah as the only principled bunch of voters in the country, and praising Mormons, even people who aren't Mormons and aren't conservatives, for saying, look, these guys really are conservative and they're really sticking to it. Vox,
I saw that, yeah.
Bloomberg View, all these places. Take a look.
Check it out. How about yourself, Matt Canham?
So we have a new internal poll from Doug Owens trying to show that he's still in this race with Mia Love, and it shows him down 10 percentage points. That's his own internal poll. 10 percentage points in a lot of other places would be considered quite a lead. He's saying that he's closing the gap, and we'll see in the last few weeks if that's true or not.
He's making up some ground there, is the idea. And Robert Gerke, for your underplayed story of the week, what do we got?
Well, I enjoyed Lee Davidson's coverage of this fight that Rob Bishop is having with the Ute tribe. They're really upset about what he's done with the Public Lands Initiative, and they've put $100,000 into a PAC that they're going to start running some anti-Bishop campaign ads. And so it's pretty interesting because Bishop talked about how he got all the players together and got them on board. The Ute tribe is very, very angry about what he's trying to do with the Public Lands Initiative. So check that out.
Check it out. Coverage at sltrib.com. I guess for my part, I'll go with a ballot item also, in addition to Tony Semerad, Constitutional Amendment A, which has a lot of kind of bizarrely opaque language. What it would do is change the oath of office to include the word Utah instead of swearing allegiance to this state. Apparently that was something that needed to be put onto the ballot. Who knew? Anyway, that does it for the Underplayed Stories. Robert Gerke, Matt Canham, Emma Penrod, George Pyle, and Tony Semerad, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you very much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you.
A quick note that the Salt Lake Tribune has a rape culture panel on November 2nd. It's called Confronting Rape Culture, a Conversation About Consent. That's November 2nd at the S.J. Quinney College of Law Moot Courtroom. Again, November 2nd at 7 p.m. That does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. Thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams, and Connor Rivers at Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune's Emily Means. Coming up next, we've got KCPW Presents here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio Presents on UPR. You can find us on Facebook at KCPW-FM. On Twitter, we are at KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for joining us again on Behind the Headlines, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for tuning in.